Welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha, a podcast shared by David Roylance. This podcast is dedicated to guiding you to completely eliminate the discontent mind and the suffering it causes by attaining enlightenment. Learn and practice the teachings of Gautama Buddha that will guide you to fully attain a peaceful, calm, serene, and content mind with joy. To support this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha or visit buddhadailywisdom.com, where you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online learning resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Now, here's our teacher to share more.
Sawadee kap. Hello and welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha. Today is our Pali Canon and English study group, and we're studying the words of the Buddha, starting a brand new book. This brand new book is titled Lowly Arts, Volume 12. This is part of the Words of the Buddha book series, so you'll be able to start learning these lowly arts that the Buddha shared. And here you're going to see various chapters where he's talking about things that he didn't actually recommend people practice in terms of ordained practitioners and aesthetics. But if you're a household practitioner, there's many lessons that you can glean out of this particular book to help strengthen your practice on your way to enlightenment as well. So I'd like to thank you all for joining. I'd like to welcome you, whether you're joining for the first time or you've been joining regularly. The way that we do this program is I'll display the words of the Buddha on the screen and then invite anybody who would like to read to be able to read the chapter. And then after someone reads the chapter, then I'll share some teachings on that. And then I'll open up to any and all questions that you guys have. Whether you're in Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, you'll be able to ask any and all questions that you like by putting that into the comment section, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like by just opening up your mic. So again, welcome to all of you guys. I'll start with this first chapter. Chapter 1 is titled, What Are the Lowly Arts? Venerable Sir, where as some aesthetics and Brahmins, feeding on the food of the dedicated, make their living by such base arts, such wrong means of livelihood as palmistry, divining by signs, portents, dreams, body marks, mouse gnawings, fire oblations, oblations from a ladle, of husk, rice powder, rice grain, ghee or oil, from the mouth or of blood, reading the fingertips, house, in garden lore, skill in charms, ghost lore, earth house lore, snake lore, poison lore, rat lore, bird lore, crow lore, fortune telling, a person's lifespan, charms against arrows, knowledge of animals' cries. Whereas some aesthetics and Brahmins make their living by such base arts as judging the marks of gems, sticks, clothes, swords, spears, arrows, weapons, women, men, boys, girls, male and female slaves, elephants, horses, buffaloes, bulls, cows, goats, rams, cocks, quail, iguanas, bamboo rats, tortoises, deer. Whereas some aesthetics and Brahmins make their living by such base arts as predicting, the chiefs will march out, the chiefs will march back, our chiefs will advance, and the other chiefs will retreat. Our chiefs will win, and the other chiefs will lose. The other chiefs will win, and ours will lose. Thus, there will be victory for one side and defeat for the other. Whereas some aesthetics and Brahmins make their living by such base arts as predicting an eclipse of the moon, the sun, a star, that the sun and moon will go on their proper course, will go astray, that a star will go on its proper course, will go astray, that there will be a shower of meteors, a blaze in the sky, an earthquake, thunder, a rising, setting, darkening, brightening of the moon, the sun, the stars, and such will be the outcome of these. Whereas some aesthetics and Brahmins make their living by such base arts as predicting good or bad rainfall, a good or bad harvest, security, danger, disease, health or accounting, computing, calculating, poetic composition, philosophizing, whereas some ascetics and Brahmins make their living by such base arts as arranging the giving and taking in marriage, engagements and divorces, declaring the time for saving and spending, bringing good or bad luck, procuring abortions, using spells to bind the tongue, binding the jaw, making the hands jerk, causing deafness, getting answers with a mirror, a girl medium, a heavenly being, worshiping the sun or great Brahma, God, breathing fire, invoking the goddess of luck. Whereas some ascetics and Brahmins, feeding on the food of the dedicated, make their living by such base arts, such wrong means of livelihood, as appeasing the heavenly beings and rendering vows to them, making earth house spells, causing virality or impotence, preparing and consecrating building sites, giving ritual rinsings and baths, making sacrifices, giving amniques, purges, expectorants, and giving ear, eye, nose, medicine, ointments and counter ointments, eye surgery, podiatry, using balms to counter the side effects of previous remedies. Okay, this particular chapter, the Buddha is describing what the lowly arts are. What you're going to see him talking about here in a moment is how he doesn't actually do any of these, because what he chose to do was give up his royal riches, walk away from the royal family and his heir to being the heir to the throne and being the king. And he decided to enter into this life of homelessness. And as part of that, people were donating food, clothing, water, shelter, and medical care to him in order to help him sustain his life. And because he was receiving those as donations, he would then give back teachings that would help people to progress on the path to enlightenment and getting to this peaceful, calm, serene, and content mind with joy. Well, these things that he's talking about here, for the most part, would promote wrong view. So if he were teaching right view as part of his teachings, and then he was promoting wrong view in terms of a way to sustain his life and make money, then his teachings would be in conflict with his practice. And what you're going to see from an enlightened being and what you're going to see from a Buddha is that their practice and the teachings are completely in sync. That's how you actually get to enlightenment, by training the mind, cultivating wisdom, and now your practice is what's determining whether you've eliminated all the 10 fetters and all those 10 pollutions. It's not just intellectual learning, it's moving the teachings into your practice so that you can then practice in such a way where your mind will ultimately move to the peace and calmness, serenity, contentedness, and joy that is the enlightened mind. So most of these things here are promoting wrong view, that the problem is outside of you, and that you can somehow solve that with a right ritual, ceremony, or worship. Instead, what the Buddha was bringing people's minds to understand is this natural law of karma, of cause and effect, or action and result, the results of your decisions, that there's a certain decision that you make, either wise or unwise, and it produces either wholesome or unwholesome results. Well, if you thought that you could do any of these kind of rites, rituals, ceremonies, or worship, and that would kind of melt away any unwise decisions that you made and the unwholesome results, this would be promoting wrong view. And if you thought that something outside of you could help you to get happiness or peace or joy or some other feeling that you're looking to acquire, then this isn't going to lead to permanent peace and permanent joy doing these things. Instead, the mind needs to cultivate wisdom to be trained in order to purify the mind of these pollutions. And that's how you actually get to enlightenment. So all of these things are things that you're going to see that he's going to share with people that he doesn't actually practice. And he suggests and encourages his ordained practitioners not to practice them as well. A lot of these, a household practitioner would maybe choose not to practice as well, but some of them, a household practitioner may actually practice, because a household practitioner's life and an ordained practitioner's life is different, because an ordained practitioner is basing their life on receiving donations from the community. So they need to spend their time, effort, energy, and resources towards developing their own mind so that then as they get closer and closer to enlightenment and they have this wisdom, they can offer that back to the people for helping them to sustain their life with food, clothing, shelter, and medical care, they're able to now share teachings back with them in order to help them. But here you can see that there's things in here like eye surgery, surgery, podiatry, and things like this. These are things that a household practitioner may very well actually do at some point. So these discourses here in this book and the chapters that we're going to be discussing today are largely directed towards the ordained practitioners and people who are sharing teachings based on receiving donations. And that's what the Buddha is talking about. But there's some of these things you can actually extrapolate for yourself, because if somebody was interested in getting to enlightenment, they're cultivating right view, they wouldn't be interested in making money on things that are promoting wrong view, because they would understand how much harm and how much damage that's doing in the community. So I'm going to walk you through the various chapters today. This one is just kind of setting up for you, what are the lowly arts? These are like rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship, and other things that the Buddha is describing ultimately, where ordained practitioners would be unwise to practice this because it's in direct conflict with their need to learn and develop on the path to enlightenment, share those teachings. And because of that, they are then giving back to the household practitioners, because the household practitioners are sharing resources with the teachers to be able to help us to be able to share the teachings. So if anybody were to practice these in they were also sharing the teachings, they would be in direct conflict with this need to give back some benefit to the people who are sharing donations with you. So let me see if you guys have any questions on this. You can put it into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or in Zoom, you can raise your hand electronically and ask any questions that you like. Okay, it looks like Mayuli is asking a question here. Sir, is it possible to see the future, or what we think we might see as the future is actually the previous life that we experienced? It is possible to see the future and know the future, particularly as your pollution is coming out of your mind. You might get to the point where you can start understanding what's going to happen in the future before it's ever happened. But it's important to understand that when that's occurring, that's not destiny or fate or anything like that. It's not seeing someone's destiny or fate. Sometimes that's what people think, because fortune tellers can see the future, that this is their destiny or their fate. But instead, what it is there's cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect that's leading up to that situation. And someone who's able to see the future is seeing a point in time in the future, but that future event or situation is based on a series of cause and effect, this whole sequence of events of cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. And yes, someone can also see previous lives as well. This is possible as well. These are actually two different things, but these two things are possible, particularly the more and more that you lift pollution out of your mind. But it's important not to cling to these. And you're going to see where the Buddha teaches that he actually doesn't do these things, even though he was capable of doing that. By the time you get to enlightenment, if your mind is able to do those things, you need to be sure not to cling to it, not cling to the ability to see the future, and not cling to any past life experiences either. Because if the mind's clinging to any of those things, you won't be able to get to full liberation, where the mind is peaceful and joyful for the rest of this life. Okay, so thank you, Mayuli, for your question there. All right, so we'll go to the next one, which is chapter 2. This is very similar to the one we just read, but here the Buddha is basically describing that he doesn't perform these things. So I don't know that I need to read this again. This is all the same stuff that he just talked about. But at the end of the paragraph, he says, the ascetic Gotama refrains from such base arts and wrong means of livelihood. Thus, the worldling would praise the Tathagata. So he goes through all those different things that we just talked about in each one of these paragraphs. He's explaining all those same things. It's just broken up, and he's ending it with, the ascetic Gotama refrains from such base arts. So this is a way that you can see where the Buddha isn't creating rules. He's not creating commandments. He's not dictating what people should do. He's not forcing anybody of what to do. He got to this mental state where the mind's peaceful and joyful. And now if somebody has a sincere interest in learning and practicing to be able to get to that, he's explaining what it is that he did in order to get to that. And as an ordained practitioner, he's saying, okay, I don't partake in any of these things in order to sustain my livelihood. But instead, what he does, you'll see in a moment, where he talks about he shares teachings in order to help people to get to enlightenment. So here, this is all the same stuff that we just read. So I don't know that we need to read that, because I also explained it earlier as well. Here, he's just talking about how this is part of his moral conduct and his practice of moral conduct. Okay, we'll go to the next one, which is chapter 3. And then here, this is exactly the same thing that he was describing in the first chapter. But now, instead of saying that he doesn't practice it, he also says that in order for a monk to be perfected in morality, that they would also not practice these same things too. So here it's all the same stuff that he was just talking about, but there's this added sentence of a monk refrains from such base arts and wrong means of livelihood. Thus, he is perfected in morality, right? Because as I mentioned, that ascetics and Brahmins, they're feeding on the food of the dedicated. That's what the Buddha is saying here, right? In each one of these paragraphs, he's saying, hey, you're living off of the donations of people who are interested in being able to get to enlightenment. And if that's what you're doing, and now you're doing all these rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship, you're promoting wrong view, and you're not giving back to the people something that they can actually use to benefit them, which is the wisdom of the path to enlightenment. And that's what he encouraged the ordained practitioners to focus their time on, is developing their mind so that they can then get to enlightenment themselves, have that wisdom to then share with household practitioners, rather than just allowing this food that in these donations that are being offered to go to waste. That these people who are dedicated in sharing offerings with ordained practitioners and teachers, the ordained practitioners and teachers should be very dedicated to their practice and their development of getting to enlightenment, so that then they have something to offer back. An ordained practitioner can't bless a household practitioner. An ordained practitioner can't give you some trinket that is going to bring you good luck or bad luck. This isn't the way that anything works in the world. Everything that happens in the world is based on certain decisions that you make. And they're either going to be wise or unwise decisions, and they're either going to produce wholesome or unwholesome results. So if you're getting wisdom back from an ordained practitioner, from a teacher, now you can make wise decisions and improve your life. So the Buddha was encouraging his ordained practitioners not to do any of these lowly arts here. So this is chapter 3. Now we'll go down to chapter 4. Chapter 4 is new content. So let's read this one. This one is titled, The Various Kinds of Pointless Talk. Monks, do not engage in the various kinds of pointless talk. That is, talk about kings, thieves, and ministers of state. Talk about armies, dangers, and wars. Talk about food, drink, garments, and beds. Talk about garlands and scents. Talk about relations, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, and countries. Talk about women and talk about heroes. Street talk and talk by the well. Talk about those departed in days gone by. Rambling chit-chat, speculation about the world and about the sea. Talk about becoming this or that. For what reason? Because, monks, this talk is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and does not lead to fading away of strong feelings, to freedom from strong feelings, to elimination, to peace, to direct knowledge or experience, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Okay, so this is a discourse for the ordained practitioners, but there are certain things that you can actually glean from this for your practice as a household practitioner. Essentially, what the Buddha is talking about here is he's guiding the ordained practitioners to stay focused on teaching the teachings that lead to enlightenment, that all this rambling chit-chat isn't actually going to produce any kind of beneficial results for the students to be able to get to enlightenment. But more importantly, notice some things that he's talking about here. Essentially, he's talking about between kings and ministers of state. What he's talking about here is that it's pointless to talk about politics. And this is for ordained practitioners and teachers. As a household practitioner, you might need to talk about that from time to time, but you just need to be sure you're not clinging to your views and opinions, and now you're arguing and hostile about your views and opinions. But as a teacher, someone who's sharing teachings, if you talked about politics and you sided with one particular party of a government, now you've just alienated at least 50% of your audience, and only 50% of the people are going to perhaps be interested to learn from you. If you speak as a teacher, as an ordained practitioner about all these different things like kings and ministers of state, which would be politics, if you talk about thieves, which would be like nowadays, if we had a famous court case that was in the public eye, and if a teacher or ordained practitioner sided with one side or the other, you're alienating the audience and the people who would potentially learn these teachings and be interested to get to enlightenment. Because some people are going to side with you, some people aren't. And the way that the unenlightened mind functions is if you experience something disagreeable, the unenlightened mind will push that person or push that situation away. So if you say things about politics or a very famous criminal case, then in this situation, half of your students are going to potentially push you away because they see that as disagreeable and their mind is unenlightened and they don't understand that they're having aversion. The Buddha gives these other types of things too, like armies and dangers and wars. Same thing. If you talk about these kinds of things, you're taking sides. And now it's better for an ordained practitioner and a teacher to just speak about the teachings that it takes to lead to enlightenment. But then as a household practitioner, you might extrapolate some of these things for your own practice as well and decide, would it really be wise for you to go into work with your coworkers and talk about some criminal case that's in the public eye? Because as you do that, again, your coworkers, half of them are going to agree with you and half of them aren't. And now they're going to have painful feelings when you're not agreeing with them and they'll end up pushing you aside. This is their aversion. Or if you talk about politics at work, this would be unwise to do that because that's not the environment to talk about politics. So you're going to need to go through this and make sure you understand each aspect of what the Buddha is sharing and realize and try to understand whether something would be wise or unwise. Because he's even talking here about villages, towns, cities, and countries. So for example, if you were siding with one particular country, or you were degrading or disparaging one particular village, town, city, or country, again, you're going to alienate certain people in your life because they are going to experience the painful feelings because they're experiencing something that's disagreeable, and now their aversion is going to kick in and they're going to push you or the situation aside, and then they might turn away from the teachings. So the Buddha is giving this guidance to ordained practitioners and teachers, but you can really go through this and make sure you understand each individual aspect of what he's saying is pointless talk, and there may be some things that you decide that would be unwise as well for your life, even as a household practitioner. Here you can see that I've got some content for you to read because these classes, I'm not able to talk about everything. So you can read and understand what it is that I'm sharing here. Here, what he's doing is he's focusing his students, the ordained practitioners, the teachers, on sharing things that are beneficial, that are going to help people to get to enlightenment. That's what would be wise to spend your time as a ordained practitioner, as a teacher, sharing with students things that are going to help them get to enlightenment. Let me know what questions you guys have on this one. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to move to the next chapter, which is chapter 5. This one's titled, The Ascetic Gotama Refrained from Pointless Talk. Whereas some ascetics and Brahmins, actually this is exactly the same as the one we just talked about, except the Buddha is now casting it and saying that he refrains from these kinds of discussions. So the first one was him advising his students to refrain from this pointless talk. And this is him just saying, hey, this is what I do, right? So this is a way to set an example rather than dictate to people what they should or shouldn't do. People could tell that the Buddha was peaceful. He was joyful. And they could spend time around him and see that he never got angry and frustrated and agitated. And then if they aspire to attain that same mental state, he's sharing with you, hey, this is what I do. Right? Because if you're a teacher and you're talking about these kinds of things in a class or even with a private student, there can be arguments, there can be bitterness, hostility that's coming at you and being vented at you. This is going to produce unwholesome results in your life. Not only are students going to turn away from you, but you'll see that people will be argumentative and hostile and bitter because they're holding on to their opinions and views So even as an enlightened being, if somebody was talking about these kinds of things, or if you were very close to enlightenment and talking about these kinds of things as a teacher or as an ordained practitioner, you're going to get all this hostility perhaps coming back to you from people who are choosing to hold on to these types of conversations and topics, even though you may not be. Okay, so let's move on to the next one, which is chapter 6. Here, this one goes into a lot more detail, so I'll go ahead and read this one. It just kind of goes through and kind of talks about it a little bit different way. A monk refrains from pointless talk. Whereas some ascetics and Brahmins remain addicted to such unedifying conversation as about kings, thieves, and ministers of state, talk about armies, dangers, and wars, talk about food, drink, garments, and beds, talk about garlands and scents, talk about relations, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, and countries, talk about women and talk about heroes, street talk and talk by the well, talk about those departed in days gone by, rambling chit-chat, speculation about the world and about the sea, talk about becoming this or that. A monk refrains from such distasteful conversations. Thus, he is perfected in morality. Monks do not engage in the various kinds of pointless talk. That is, talk about kings, thieves, and ministers of state. Talk about armies, dangers, and wars. Talk about food, drink, garments, and beds. Talk about garlands and scents. Talk about relations, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, and countries. Talk about women and talk about heroes. Street talk and talk by the well. Talk about those departed in days gone by. Rambling chit-chat. Speculation about the world and about the sea. Talk about becoming this or that. For what reason? Because, monks, this talk is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and does not lead to fading away of strong feelings, to freedom from strong feelings, to elimination, to peace, to direct knowledge, experience, to enlightenment, to nibbana. When you talk, monks, you should talk about, this is discontentedness. You should talk about, this is the cause of discontentedness. You should talk about, this is the elimination of discontentedness. You should talk about, this is the way leading to the elimination of discontentedness. For what reason? Because, monks, this talk is beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and leads to fading away of strong feelings, to freedom from strong feelings, to elimination, to peace, to direct knowledge, experience, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Therefore, monks, an effort should be made to understand this is discontentedness. An effort should be made to understand this is the cause of discontentedness. An effort should be made to understand this is the elimination of discontentedness. An effort should be made to understand this is the way leading to the elimination of discontentedness. Okay, so here you can see the Buddha is encouraging the ordained practitioners to focus on describing the teachings that lead to enlightenment. He's describing that they should discuss the Four Noble Truths, that by discussing the Four Noble Truths, this is discontentedness, the cause, the elimination, and the path forward, that's what's going to lead to improvement on the path to enlightenment, because that's the very first teaching of the Buddha where you can have a breakthrough to understanding what's really causing the difficulties in the unenlightened mind so that you can then actually solve it. So he's encouraging the teachers and ordained practitioners to not talk about these pointless things. Instead, to focus on teaching the path that leads to enlightenment. So let me know what questions you guys have here. Okay, not seeing any questions here, so we'll move on to this next chapter, chapter 7. This one is titled The Three Kinds of Wanderers, First Discourse. There are, Brahmin, these three kinds of wanderers. What three? 1. The mystic wonder. 2. The wonder of mind reading. And 3. The wonder of instruction. And what, Brahmin, is the mystic wonder? Here, a monk wields the various kinds of mystic potency. Having been one, he becomes many. Having been many, he becomes one. He appears and vanishes. He goes unhindered through a wall, through a protective barrier, through a mountain, as though through space. He dives in and out of the earth, as though it were water. He walks on water without sinking, as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, he travels in space like a bird. With his hand, he touches and strokes the moon and sun, so powerful and mighty. He exercises mastery with the body as far as the Brahma world. This is called the mystic wonder. And what, Brahman, is the wonder of mind reading? There is one who, by means of some clue, declares, your thought is thus, such is what you are thinking, your mind is in such a state. And even if he makes many declarations, they are exactly so and not otherwise. Again, someone does not declare the state of mind on the basis of a clue, but he hears the sound of people, spirits, and deities speaking, and then declares, your thought is thus, such is what you are thinking, your mind is in such and such a state. And even if he makes many declarations, they are exactly so and not otherwise. Again, someone does not declare the state of mind on the basis of a mark, or by hearing the sound of people, spirits, or deities speaking, but he hears the sound of the diffusion of thought as one is thinking and examining some matter, and then declares, your thought is thus, such is what you are thinking, your mind is in such and such a state, and even if he makes many declarations, they are exactly so and not otherwise. Again, someone does not declare the state of mind on the basis of a mark, or by hearing the sound of people, spirits, or deities speaking, or by hearing the sound of the diffusion of thought as one is thinking and examining some matter. But with his own mind, he encompasses the mind of one who has attained concentration without thought and examination, and he understands this person's mental activities are so disposed that immediately afterwards he will think this thought. And even if he makes many declarations, they are exactly so and not otherwise. This is called the wonder of mind reading. And what, Brahman, is the wonder of instruction? Here, someone instructs others thus, think in this way and not in that way. Attend to this and not to that. Abandon this and enter and dwell in that. This is called the wonder of instruction. So here the Buddha is essentially talking about three different skills or qualities that you can develop as part of your journey to enlightenment. As you're lifting out more and more pollution of the mind, these are things that are potentials. The Buddha is describing here a kind of supernatural thing where he talks about the mystic wonder. I've never witnessed that for myself, but the Buddha is talking about that. The mind reading, I've witnessed this. This is absolutely 100% ability that somebody could potentially develop on their journey to enlightenment, is to be able to read the mind of others and know their thoughts before the person gives any inclination of what they're thinking or anything. And then he talks about this wonder of instruction, the ability to share the teachings that lead to enlightenment, which you're going to see in the teachings of the Buddha, that he describes these three things almost like as if they're miracles, but he describes that he doesn't practice those first two, the mystic wonder and the wonder of mind reading, but instead he practices this wonder of instruction. Because as your mind is awakening, you might notice certain qualities like this where you can know the future or you can read other people's minds. These are all things that can occur as your mind is lifting out pollution, and you need to keep your mind grounded in what it is that you're actually looking to accomplish, which is liberation of the mind. So if you cling to being able to read other people's minds, for example, then your mind isn't going to be able to get to full liberation. So you're going to need to be willing to let that go, even if you start to experience that. So the Buddha teaches and provides this miracle of instruction, or this wonder of instruction, so to speak. And he talks about that in his teachings. But here he's describing these three. He doesn't say here that this is the one he performs, but you'll see that in other teachings. Let me know what questions you guys have on this chapter. You can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So I'm going to move on to the next chapter. This is chapter 8, which is the second discourse of the same thing. So all the reading is exactly the same, where he's describing the mystic of power and potency. He's describing the mind reading, and he's also describing the instruction. And this is the one where he ultimately says, okay, is what I do is I actually provide instruction and guidance for people to get to enlightenment. And that's what he's describing here. So you can read that on your own time. If you have questions, just let me know. I will be pleased to answer any questions you guys have on that. Now we go to chapter 9. Here, this one is titled, The Perfectly Enlightened One Prohibits Monks from Exhibiting a Wonder of Mystic Power. Here, this one, the Buddha is going to describe for you about how he discourages people from doing any kind of mystical things. So here, I'll read it for you. The Venerable Pindola, the Bharadvaja, shown his mystic power, having risen above the ground, having taken hold of that bowl of the great merchant of Rajagaha, was brought down by him, circled three times around Rajagaha. Then the perfectly enlightened one, on this occasion, in this connection, having had the community of monks gather, questioned the Venerable Pindola, the Bharadvaja, saying, is it true, as it is said, Bharadvaja, that the bowl of the great merchant of Rajagaha was fetched down by you? It is true, Venerable Sir. It is not suiting, Bharadvaja. It is not becoming. It is not fitting. It is not worthy of an aesthetic. It is not allowable. It is not to be done. How can you, Bharadvaja, I'll just say student, on account of a cheap wooden bowl, exhibit a condition of further men, a wonder of mystic power to householders? As student, a woman exhibits her loincloth on account of a cheaply stamped masaka, a small bean used as a standard of weight in value, hence a small coin of very low value. Even so by you, student, was a condition of further men, a wonder of mystic power exhibited to householders on account of a cheap wooden bowl. It is not, student, for pleasing those who are not yet pleased, nor for increasing the number of those who are pleased. But, student, it is displeasing to those who are not pleased as well as to those who are pleased, and it causes wavering in some. Having guided him, having given reason talk, he addressed the monks, saying, monks, a condition of further men, a wonder of mystic power, is not to be exhibited to householders. Whoever should exhibit them, there is an offense of wrongdoing. Break, monks, this wooden bowl, having reduced it to fragments, give them to monks as perfume to mix with ointment. And monks, a wooden bowl should not be used. Whoever should use one, there is an offense of wrongdoing. So here the Buddha is saying to his students that performing these supernatural things, that it actually creates difficulties where it discourages people from actually going forward in learning the path to enlightenment. You'll see in other places where the Buddha talks about this too, where he talks about how this kind of spreading throughout the community, it just looks bad for people that are truly looking to get on the path to enlightenment, that if it's kind of like this sideshow or this circus that is being performed, then people might think, oh, that's the reason why to get to enlightenment is so I can perform those miracles. No, that's not the way to get to enlightenment, and that's not the goal of getting to enlightenment. The goal is to eliminate the discontent feelings. So he encouraged his students that as they were able to do these types of things like mind reading and these supernatural things, to not display them for other people, that it would be unwise. Instead, stay focused on sharing the teachings that lead to enlightenment. That's the ultimate goal, is to get to the purification of mind where the mind's peaceful and joyful, and you can eliminate the cycle of rebirth as well. So let me know if you guys have questions on this one. Looks like Mayuli has a question here. In terms of mind reading, based on your experience, does that come and go, or are you able to access when needed? If so, how much are you able to access? So from my experience, the way that mind reading works is it's not that you sit down and you consciously try to fixate and try to read that person's mind. It's just that when you're around somebody, it just happens. It comes into your mind, and immediately you know that it's not something you actually can actively try to do. There's certainly people who do that, but at least in my experience, when I experienced this, it was like I would be around other people, and somebody would sit down next to me, like at a temple. I was at a place where the public would come and talk with teachers, and when certain people would sit down, I would look to them and I would say, have you had any family members die recently? And they said, yes, my father. And then like right away, I like knew what was wrong with her father and was able to explain it to her and things like this. So these kinds of things I didn't try to do, it just happened. And then as this was happening, it was quite powerful because for a good 3 to 6 months, I was able to read people's minds, and I wasn't actively trying to do it, but I was giving them information that they needed and they were interested in having all so many years, but yet they couldn't communicate with their dead relatives. But ultimately, that wasn't my interest, and I wasn't interested in holding on to that. So I just let it fade away and let it go away. And now there's situations where I already know the future of what's going to happen before it happens, but I don't share it with anybody. I just keep it to myself. No need to go out and share it with people. Like there'll be certain student, for example, that I haven't heard from for 6 months or a year. And then I'll know 2 or 3 days ahead that this person's going to contact me, for example. And there's no reason for me to go out and show that to other people and tell other people that I have that ability. But there are certain things like this that you will experience, and you need to get to the point where not only are you not displaying them for others and you're not clinging to them, but also you don't allow any conceit to arise in the mind that you have these special abilities. Because if you do, then the mind's not going to be able to get to liberation and to peace and to joy, to that enlightened mental state. So they do come and go, Mayuli. And that would be the way that you would like it to do, you know, so you're not interested in holding on to the ability to do those kinds of things. But if the mind does it, then it does it. No big deal. Okay, so I don't see any other questions anywhere. So we have this last chapter, chapter 10, which is titled, The Perfectly Enlightened One Prohibits Monks from Boasting About a Non-Existence of State of Further Men in Oneself. Whatever monk should boast with reference to himself of a state of further men, attainment of jhanas or stage of enlightenment, sufficient noble wisdom and insight, though not knowing it fully, and saying, this I know, this I see, then if later on he, being pressed or not being pressed, fallen, should aspire to be purified, and should say, your venerable sir, I said that I know what I do not know, see what I do not see. I spoke idly, falsely, with conceit, apart from the undue estimate of himself. He also is one who is defeated. He is not in communion. So here what the Buddha is saying is that it's unwise to talk about your attainments of the jhanas or any of the stages of enlightenment. Because if you did so, that would be your arrogance, your boastfulness, and your conceit. One of the best ways to know somebody is not enlightened is that they will tell you that they are enlightened. So if you're going around talking to people about all your attainments and your stages of enlightenment and where you think you are, this is just the mind being arrogant and boastful. There's no reason to go around and talk about that with other people. You might need at certain times to talk about it with your teacher. You might think that you're in the first stage of enlightenment or in a certain jhana or anything else that you might have attained. And you might be trying to check in with your teacher so that you can determine whether you've attained that jhana or that stage of enlightenment so that then you can plot steps for your continued and future development. But that's got a real purpose behind it. It's on a one-on-one basis and a private conversation so that you can plot steps for your continuous growth. Whereas if you were just out and about in the community talking about these kinds of things, this is one looking for admiration, looking for people to give you something. There's some desire there. There's the conceit in there. And it's best to not talk about those things. But if you need to talk about it with your teacher because you're trying to learn about the fetters, you're trying to learn about the attainments and the stages of enlightenment, you're trying to plot your steps forward to be able to develop on the path to enlightenment, that's understandable. And that's something that you would potentially need to do from time to time. So that's something that you should feel comfortable to do. But talking about it with anybody else or putting it on your Facebook page or anything like this, that's a good indication that you haven't really attained anything at all. So it's best to keep those things to yourself and between you and your teacher for your own personal development. So let me know what questions you guys have here. You can put it into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So this was just a short little class because the chapters that we have are pretty much just repeating, and there's a lot of similar things that are being shared, just a little bit of changes here and there. So there wasn't much to actually go through, but what I would do with, if I was you with this time, is if you haven't already read these chapters, be sure to read them thoroughly and read the reflections that I've shared with you. Because in there, you're going to see how I'm describing each chapter in much more detail than I'm able to do in the classes. So you might decide to download these from our website, buddhadailywisdom.com. You can get access to them there for free. You can take it and go print it. You can order printed versions on Amazon if you have access to Amazon. Or you can get a printed version here at the temple. I have printed versions there as well. So it would be wise to help you to be able to develop on the path to enlightenment, to not only be coming to classes, but to be reading too, because there's so many details in the books that I don't actually share in the classes. And then there's certain things in the classes that I don't have the ability to share in the books. So a combination of the two will really help round out your practice. So thank you all for your questions. Thank you all for your dedication to learning and practicing the teachings. Perhaps we'll see you guys in a future class. Have a very lovely and wonderful rest of your day. Sawadee ka.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To provide support for this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha. To access more teachings, visit buddhadailywisdom.com. There, you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Remember, to establish a daily, consistent meditation practice, along with learning and practicing these teachings, a well-developed meditation practice is the foundation in which to train the mind to attain enlightenment.